Welcome to the Software Process Measurement Cast number 541. I'm Tom Cagley, your host. In the Spamcast 541, we discuss using guardrails in decision-making. Guardrails are a tool to ensure alignment with the organization's goals and objectives and to keep people on the right path. And, most importantly, to allow people to be empowered to make decisions at a lower level of the organization. Well-formed guidelines conform to five attributes that help teams and individuals make decisions. Our second segment features John M. Quigley and his Alpha and Omega of Product Development column. John discusses reciprocal agreements and their impact on teams and products. In Reread Saturday News, we continue our poll to decide on the next book in the Reread series. We will announce the next book Saturday, 13th of April, 2019. Make your opinion known. There's a poll in the show notes. And while you're at it, maybe, why don't you tell us what you're reading? The Reread Saturday Interregnum. Guardrails in decision-making. Guardrails are a tool to ensure alignment with the organization's goals and objectives and to help keep people on the right track. Well-formed guardrails conform to five attributes that help teams and individuals make decisions. The power of guardrails lies in the fact that they shape decisions by defining boundaries. As a consultant, the first time a client asks a question, the answer almost always needs to be, "It depends." No boundaries or guardrails for a decision have been established. The four values stated in the Agile Manifesto establish a set of guardrails to guide decisions. For example, the manifesto states, "We have come to value working software over comprehensive documentation." That value does not state that documentation is never a good idea, but establishes a bias when deciding how much documentation the work requires. The value, as stated in the manifesto, provides a starting point for guiding behavior. Four common ways guardrails impact decision-making include: 1. Guardrails define a range of acceptable behavior. The range between the guardrails allow a team and individuals to determine their course of action. Self-determination empowers people who are closest to the work to react to the situation. This is a form of spectrum thinking. Remember to listen to the interview that we did with Julia Wester. Link in the show notes, by the way. 2, guardrails speed up the decision process. Providing a range of possible solutions to a question provides a starting point for decisions, cutting down the time needed to make a decision. Most of the readers of the blog have taken tests. In general, which type of question takes longer to answer? A question requiring a short, free-form answer, or one that is multiple choice? The multiple choice question provides a set of answer guardrails to speed up the answering process. 3, guardrails provide teams and individuals independence to make business decisions based on context without sacrificing alignment. One of the standard tenets of efficient software development, all forms by the way, is that the business defines what needs to be done. The what defines the business problem the developers need to solve. These are guardrails. The technical team then defines how they will solve the business problem. Technical and architectural standards, guardrails, provide an environment that allows a team to make decisions without having to ask for permission. 4, guardrails reduce risk. During a recent trip to India, I used a set of guardrails to ensure I did not eat food that would have upset my wimpy guts. If solid food was not cooked or peelable, I steered clear. I used the guardrail to reduce the risk that I would lose time that would be better spent seeing India. The architectural guideline provides the same service for software developers. The goal of the guardrail is to reduce the possibility of rework based on research and experiments performed by others, so that as much time as possible is spent solving business problems. Guardrails define a range of possible decisions. In doing so, guardrails constrain behavior, but at the same time empower teams and individuals to make decisions within the range with far less oversight. An agile mindset requires empowerment and responsibility so people can make decisions when they need to be made. Guardrails provide organizational support and guidance needed to speed up the decision process while keeping decisions aligned to core goals and values of the organizations. Thoughts, comments, all welcome. Please feel free to reach out to us at spamcastinfo@gmail.com or 01-440-668-5717. Leave a message. We'll talk about it on the show. John M. Quigley, welcome to the Software Process and Measurement Cast.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here again.
John, it's always great when you bring your alpha and omega product development to the cast. John, today, reciprocal agreements. Why do we care?
That's a good question. Why do we care? From my perspective, it's at least in part, it's the thing that holds us together. It can hold us together as a team or as a group, right? Somebody does you a favor and you sort of do the same thing. I point to people to help you build your business. You point to people to help me build my business. Even in a project setting, I help you with some part of the deliverable that you may be struggling with because you're my team member and you need a little bit of help. And then, so when it's my time in the barrel, so to say, and I'm kind of under the gun, to use a bunch of hack phrases, you come and rescue me as well.
Well, and I don't think they are really hack phrases. I mean, we can go as simple, in my estimation, one of the classic reciprocal agreements that you see. Well, the first one is easy, right? I go to work for an organization. I get up every morning. I put on clothes and I actually go to work and, I get to help people do cool things, but I'm not doing that just so that I can help people to do cool things. I'm doing that so that they actually pay me money. So there's an agree, and that's a relatively formal reciprocal agreement. I give them value; they give me value.
Keep a roof over your head and feed your family at the same time.
Absolutely. Exactly. Another far less formal, and I've seen this in almost every team that I've gotten close to, is that you'll end up going out for lunch one day and somebody will pick up the check. And then somebody will pick it up the next time because there's an expectation that everybody will have their turn in the barrel and that you're not a freeloader, right? So you want to avoid that whole idea of a freeloading effect.
Right. I think not carrying your weight with the team in any vein,
right?
The external stuff and the internal stuff, exactly.
I mean, so I think this whole idea of reciprocity is pretty ingrained in our human nature. I do something kind for you, you will feel obligated to do something kind back, even if I don't do it with that idea. I mean, we see it every once in a while. You'll hear about people in line at a fast food restaurant, and somebody will pay for the person behind them. And there's a chain reaction over time where people, one person pays, the other person pays, and it goes down the line where we're all, in essence, even though we can't pay the person who started it back, we're paying it forward. That's a form of reciprocal agreement. How does that translate into the workplace?
You find yourself, if you're in a project and you're carrying some of the work, right, a set of tasks, it's not difficult to understand that somebody could get stuck and have some difficulty figuring something out. I once worked at a place, it was a skunk works place for heavy trucks. We did early prototype systems. And I remember there was this problem I was working on. It was, I don't want to go too much into the details because it's madness. But it needed to do a comparison of external temperatures, internal temperatures, calculation of what was called the wet tank in terms of dew point, and then know when to purge the water out of the tank and reload the air back into the tank, right? So it was some pretty heavy math and intensive stuff. And the controller that was picked was a pretty, if I recall, it was not a math intensive controller. I want to say it was a RISC controller, but it might not have been a RISC controller. It might have very well have been, though. And I was trying to figure out, how in the world am I going to do this? I'm really stuck when it comes to some of this complicated stuff and doing in terms of the math and doing it quickly, because that was part of the requirement. And the other guy that worked in the office was, he'd been around for a very long time, and he said, okay, let's walk through some scenarios how we can do this. And we ended up settling in on something after pitching a bunch of different ideas how to make it happen, how to make it work. And if he wouldn't have been there, if he was not there, I have a feeling that I might still be trying to figure out how to do these calculations with a PIC controller, for example.
And that would have been bad?
Yeah, that would have been bad for my career.
Okay.
Yeah, I would have probably not gone much farther than that company and probably would have went to another smaller and to the farm league, so to say. Not that that might not have been bad, but I prefer to, you know, to have a path that looks more like this than what I can imagine that would have been like. So I felt beholden to him. He was a good guy. He knew his stuff. Probably one of the sharpest software people I know when it comes to embedded work. I, even to this day, not just for that, but at least in part for that, if he called me and said, hey, John, I need you to help me do something, I would be glad. I said, hey, Bob, okay, what do I need to help you with? I'm here for you. So
reciprocity isn't a perfect world. There's something that in essence indicates that you're less likely to actually do a favor for someone if they've done a favor for you. There's something along the lines of the Ben Franklin effect?
Yeah, which essentially says if I do you a favor, if you ask me to do you a favor and I do it, and you come back to me later and you ask for another favor, I'm more likely to do that favor than it would have been if we never would have done that favor the first time. So in this case, it's less like a reciprocal agreement and more like once we establish the relationship, I'm willing to put myself out there for you more than once without the expectation of some quid pro quo going on.
Why do you think there's no expectation of quid pro quo?
I'm not sure that there's a, maybe there is an expectation, but it's underlying. It's not the most important thing. Maybe it's the establishment of the relationship that seems to be more important, or the interaction in general that seems to be more important than the fact that I can't do this for him because he hasn't done anything for me yet. That probably is not very cognitively satisfying to walk around thinking that everything has to be a tally sheet.
One of the more important, and I would say somewhat formally acknowledged, reciprocal agreements comes in Agile when a team agrees and does some form of commitment, says, we'll pull this work, we'll get this work done in this sprint. And the reciprocal agreement is that the product owner won't change his mind or her mind during the sprint, won't add to their burden, won't change things around. So there's, hey, we'll do it in the next 2 weeks or the next 1 week, and you won't muck with us while that's happening, kind of thing. So I think we see these kind of reciprocal agreements. By the way, that's why if that's a really important concept when you're building trust between product owner and a team. And also one of the reasons it generally makes sense anytime a team can't get all the way done, or a product owner can't not mess with the backlog of a team during a sprint, that I recommend you make the sprint or iteration shorter, because you can hold that line for a week easier than you can for two. you can hold that line for 2 weeks easier than you can for 6 months or 6 months. Go back to the good, or 6 months. Remember the good old days, right? Back when we were young, and between you would have phases that ran years, and you were supposed to have signed off, and people would go through this enormous dance of silliness, you know, signing off requirements, signing off a design document. It's frozen. You can't change it. Of course you had to, because nothing, even in the 1990s or the 2000s, nothing ever stayed the same for more than a couple of days in a row anyway.
Yeah. I have to say that your experience of that approach is a little more extreme than mine. I don't think I've ever worked at a company where 6 months was this is what we're doing, and it's stable for 6 months. It might be more like 90 days, though, you know, which is still not good. And I would add one more thing to the reciprocal agreement, is that the product owners are going to be available to answer questions when we get stuck, because in my experience, that can be a problem when they don't fulfill that. Then we're kind of sitting there in a holding pattern trying to figure out what the next thing needs to be, because we had this one question that we really need to ask the product owner how this really needs to be if we didn't capture it in some good way up front.
What's the other side to that agreement? So if I'm a product owner and I agree that I will work with the team on a daily basis to pull one of the 12 basic Agile principles, what's the quid pro quo?
From the team that we're going to deliver something that you're asking for at the quality that you need it in the time that you expect it, in as much as we can do that.
Oh, you went fuzzy on me there at the end.
Yeah, it's all part of that learning, though. Chances are good that because it is set down to a week or 2 weeks, the scope is something that we understand well, and we should be able to do that. But, you know, when you get in there and start knocking around, you just really never know how that's going to turn out.
There has
to be an option for entertaining that might happen.
Well, of course that might happen, but you and I both have coded, you and I have both tested, so we've seen the inside of a program and understand how they all have to fit together, and the degrees of whether or not they're complicated or complex, we don't need to go there. But let's assume they're just basically complicated. We understand that there are those sorts of issues, but having an out and making the out easy, you know, I think sometimes makes it too easy to step away from one side or the other of that reciprocal agreement. And therefore, there is no trust. I can say that I'm going to do something. I'm going to say I'm going to have it ready for a release, and it's not there. And somebody's gone down the path of planning, talking to customers, doing those sorts of things, spending real money to actually market a product, and it's not there. I don't know how you explain that if that's an all-the-time kind of scenario. I think that's why organizations have outsourced work and said, you know what, we can't trust you. You guys all go away. We're going to send it over there where we can hold their feet to the fire, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Sorry. I got a little passionate there.
I can see that, and you're right. If you have too many outs or too easy out, then it becomes an excuse rather than a situation that can arise where things can't exactly roll out as planned. Yep, you're right.
John, reciprocal agreements, I think, are an important component to whether you're agile or not agile. I think they're an important component of doing business. Your final thoughts on reciprocal agreements?
It's a part, like you say, it's part of doing business. It's part of agile. It's actually part of team building and team development. It's that fundamental.
Agreed. John, how can people continue this conversation with you? How would they reach out and touch you, so to speak?
I can be reached at LinkedIn, John M. Quigley on LinkedIn. I can be reached on Twitter at John M. Quigley, and you can visit the Value Transformation website, valuetransform.com. There's even discussion boards over there where you can put some questions and things like that. I answer some questions for people on certain topic areas periodically.
John, thank you for bringing your wonderful Alpha and Omega of product development to the Software Process and Measurement Cast.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure as always. I really get a kick out of these. I learn stuff from them as well, and it's a lot of fun.
In the Spamcast 542, we will feature our interview with Kevin Rush. Mr. Rush has developed an innovative approach for facilitating sprint planning. Kittens, exploding kittens, and fat cats are used to help teams probe whether the team understands the story and if it's broken down well enough for the team. Kevin is a scrum master at Highland Software. If process improvement is a never-ending journey, why do so many people ask, are we there yet?